Osho, my way, the way of the white clouds, discourse number 14, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India.
A very basic question. Existence itself is divine. Then from where the evil comes? From where the bad, the immoral, the unacceptable comes? The good is okay, because we have made it synonymous with God. Good means God. But from where the bad comes? This has puzzled humanity for centuries. As back as we can go, this problem has always been there in the mind of man. The logical solution, the solution that the mind can find, is to divide existence, to create a duality, to say that there is God, which is good, and there is evil, devil, Beelzebub, Satan, which is bad. Mind thinks the problem is solved. So all that is bad comes from devil and all that is good comes from God. But the problem is not solved. The problem is only pushed a little back. The problem remains the same. You have pushed it a step, but nothing is solved, because from where the devil comes? If God is the creator, then he must have created devil in the beginning, in the first place. God is not the supreme creator, and devil has been always there, just as an enemy, the antagonistic force, then both are eternal. If devil is not created, then devil cannot be destroyed. So the conflict will continue eternally. God cannot be. Devil will be always there, disturbed. This is the problem for Christian theology, Mohammedan theology, Zoroastrian theology, because all these three theologies have followed the simple solution that mind suggests. But mind cannot solve it. There is another possibility which doesn't come from the mind and will be difficult for the mind to understand. That possibility has arisen in the East, particularly in India. And that possibility is that there is no devil, there is no basic duality. Only God exists, there is no other force. This is what Advaita, the non-dual philosophy, means. Only God is, but we see the evil is there. Hindus say that the evil exists in your interpretation, not in itself. You call it bad because you cannot understand it, or because you are disturbed by it. It is your attitude that makes it bad or appear bad. There is no evil. Evil cannot exist. Only God exists. Only divine exists. Now I will take your problem against this background. Two children are born. One is good, one is bad. Why you call one good? And why you call the other bad? Really, is it reality or your interpretation? Which child is good and why? If the child is obedient, the child is good. If the child is disobedient, the child is bad. One who follows you is good. One who resists is bad. Whatsoever you say, the one accepts it. If you say sit silently, the one sits. But the other tries to disobey, tries to be rebellious, the other is bad. This is your interpretation. You are not saying anything about the children, you are saying something about your mind. Why the obedient is good? In fact, the obedient ones have never been brilliant, never been very radiant. They have always been dull. No obedient child has been a great scientist, or a great religious man, or a great poet. No child who is obedient. Only disobedient ones have been great inventors, creators. Only the rebellious one transcends the old and reaches to the new and into the unknown. But for the parent's ego, the obedient one feels good because it helps your ego. When the child follows you, whatsoever you say, you feel good. When the child resists and denies you, you feel bad. But a really alive child will be rebellious. Why he should follow you? Who are you and why he should follow you? Just because you are a father? What you have done to be a father? You have been just a passage, and that too very unconscious. Your sex is not a conscious act. You have been forced by unconscious forces to move into it. The child is just an accident. You were never expecting. You were not consciously aware to whom you are giving an invitation to come. The child has suddenly come as a stranger. You have fathered it, but you are not the father. When I say you have fathered it, it is a biological thing. You were not needed. Even a syringe can do that. But you are not a father because you are not conscious. You have not given the invitation. You have not asked a particular soul to enter the woman of your to enter the womb of your wife, your beloved. You have not worked for it. And when the child is born, what you have been doing to it? When you say the child should follow you, are you confident enough that you know the truth, that he should follow you? Are you confident enough, certain, that you have realized something, that the child should follow? You can force on the child because child is weak and you are strong. That is the only thing, the only difference between you and your child. Otherwise, you are also childless, ignorant. You have not grown, you are not mature. You will get angry just like the child. You will get jealous just like the child. And you will play with toys just like the child. Your toys may be different, a little bigger, that's all. What's your life, where you have reached, what wisdom you have gained, so that the child should follow you and should say yes to you, whatsoever you demand? A father will be conscious of it. He will not force anything on the child. Rather, he will allow the child to be himself. He will help the child to be himself. He will give freedom to the child. Because if he has known anything, he must have known that only through freedom the inner grows. If he has experienced anything in his life, he knows well that experience needs freedom. The more freedom, the richer is your experience. The less freedom, there is no possibility to experience. If there is no freedom at all, then you can have borrowed experiences, imitations, shadows, but never the real thing, never the authentic. Fathering a child will mean giving him more and more freedom, making him more and more independent, allowing him to move into the unknown where you have never been. He should transcend you. He should go ahead than you. He should surpass all the boundaries that you have known. He must be helped, but not forced. Because once you start forcing, you are killing. You are murdering the child. The spirit needs freedom. It grows in freedom and only in freedom. You will be happy if the child is rebellious, if you are really a father. Because no father would like to kill the spirit of the child. But you are not fathers. You are ill with your own illnesses. When you force on a child so that he follows you, you are simply saying that you would like to dominate someone and you cannot get in the world. But this small child, at least you can dominate him, possess him. You are being a politician to the child. You want to fulfill some unfulfilled desires through the child. Domination, dictatorship. At least you can be a dictator to the child. He is so weak. He is so young and helpless. And he depends on you so much that you can force anything. But by forcing, you are killing him. You are not giving birth to him. You are destroying him. And the child who follows will look good because he is dead. And the child who is rebellious will look bad because he is alive. Because we have missed lives ourselves, we are against life. Because we are already dead. Dead before death. We always like to kill others. Subtle are the ways in the name of love you can kill. In the name of compassion you can kill. In the name of service you can kill. Beautiful names we find. Deep down the murderer is hidden. Realize this. Then you will not think in terms that this child is good and that child is bad. Don't interpret. Every person is unique. Every person is different. The divine creative force is such that it never repeats. So only say this much, that this child is different from that. Don't say this is good and that is bad. You don't know what is good and what is bad. This child is obedient, that child is disobedient. But no one knows what is good. And don't force. If this child by his own spontaneity is obedient, then it is good. This is his nature. Help it to grow. And if that child is rebellious, disobedient, this is his nature. Help him to grow. Let one grow to be a deep yes-sayer. Let another grow to be a deep no-sayer. But don't interpret. Because the moment you interpret, you start destroying. This is his nature to say yes, and that is his nature to say no, and both are needed. Life will be very flat and dull if there is nobody to say no. If everybody is a yes sayer, it will be absolutely dull and stupid. The no sayer is needed. That is the polar opposite. Obedience will be meaningless if there is nobody to rebel. Don't choose. Simply feel the difference and help. And don't force yourself on them. Don't be violent. And every father is violent, every mother is violent. And you can be violent because you are violent in the name of love. Nobody is going to criticize you because you say you love your child so much that you have to beat him. You love him so much that you have to put him right. You say because you love, that's why you are trying to put him right. He is going wrong. Are you certain what is wrong and what is good? Nobody is certain. Nobody can be certain. The phenomena is such. Because a thing that is good this moment becomes bad that moment. The direction that seems bad in the beginning turns to be good in the end. Life is a flux. Every moment changing. So a real father or a real mother will give his or her children only awareness, not morals. Because morals are dead. You say, this is good, follow. But next moment the thing becomes bad. And what the child is supposed to do? Next moment the whole life changes. It is changing. It is a continuum of change. And your morals are fixed. You say, this is good, this has to be followed. Then you become dead, life goes on changing, you go on fixed with your morals. That's why religious persons look so dull. Their eyes vacant, superficial, no depth. Because depth is possible only if you move with the river of life. So what a father or a mother should give as a gift to their children? Only awareness. They will make the children more aware. And they will allow freedom and tell them, be alert and move with freedom. Even if you have to err, don't be afraid, because life learns through errors also. One becomes alert through errors also. So don't be afraid. It's a human to err. And if you err with alertness, only one thing will happen. You will not commit the same mistake again and again. Once you will commit, you will experience it, you will become alert about it, and it will disappear. And it will make you richer. And you go ahead, unafraid. Just remember one thing, that whatsoever you pass through, be more conscious. If you say yes, say it consciously. If you say no, say it consciously. And don't get hurt when a child says no. Because who are to fix a child? He comes through you. You are just a passage. But don't become a dictator. Love never dictates. And if you never dictate, then this goodness and goodness and badness will disappear. Then you will love both. Your love will flow unconditionally. And that's how God's love is flowing unconditionally to this world. I have heard somebody said to Junaid, a Sufi mystic, that a very evil man comes to listen to you, and you are allowing him too much closeness and intimacy. Throw him out. He is not a good man. Junaid said, if God is not throwing him out of existence, who am I? If God accepts him, I am not superior than God. God gives him life. God helps him to be alive. And that man is still young and fresh, and he will live long, longer than you. So who am I to decide? God is sovereign on both the good and the bad. The situation is absolutely clear, crystal clear, that for God there is no good, no bad. And when I say God, I don't mean a person somewhere sitting there out in the sky. That is anthropocentric attitude. We conceive of God in our own image. There is nobody sitting there. God means the whole, the totality of existence. A bad man breathes as dutifully as a good man. The sinner is accepted for existence as a saint. The existence makes no difference. But because of dualistic thinking, Christian, Mohammedan, Zoroastrian, we think in terms of conflict. There is a story. There was a town, Sodom, in old Israel. The people were very much pervert in that town, sexually pervert, homosexuals. So it is said that God destroyed the town. The whole town was destroyed. A great fire descended and everybody was killed. After many, many centuries, one Hasid mystic was asked that when God destroyed Sodom, there must have been at least few good persons in that town. All were destroyed. So the questioner said, we can accept that the bad were destroyed because they were bad, but why the good? Now look at the cunning mind. The hussy thought over it and said he desired good also, so that they can be witnesses for these bad people, that these are bad. This is cunning calculation. This is just saving the face. The real thing is, for God there is no good, no bad. When he creates both. When he destroys both, unconditionally. This is really foolish, this attitude of good and bad. A person smoking cigarettes becomes bad. A person enjoying alcohol becomes bad. A person who has fallen in love with somebody else's wife becomes bad. And we think God is also sitting there and calculating that this man smokes, this man has fallen into adultery, this man is alcoholic, let this fellow come and I will see. This is foolish if God is calculating about such trivial things. This is our tiny mind. For existence, there is no interpretation and no division. Good and bad are human conceptions, not divine. And every society has its own conceptions of good and bad. Every age changes and has its own conceptions of good and bad. There is no absoluteness about good and bad. Good and bad are relative. Relative to society, to culture, relative to us. God is absolute. For him there is no distinction. And if you are also deep in meditation where thoughts disappear, then there is no distinction. Because good and bad is a thought. When you are silent, what is good and what is bad? The moment the idea arises, this is good, that is bad, the silence has been lost. In deep meditation, there is nothing, no good, no bad. Lao Tse is reported to have said that a hair's distinction and heaven and hell are set apart. In the mind of a meditator, if even a little distinction arises, then the whole world is divided. Meditation is non-distinction, no distinction. You simply look, and you look the whole, you don't divide it. You don't say, this is ugly, that is beautiful, this is good, that is bad. You don't say anything. You simply are. You don't say anything. You don't make any division. The non-dual is there. In meditation you become a God. People think in meditation they will see God. This is wrong. There is nobody to be seen. God is not an object. In meditation you become God, because all distinctions disappear. In meditation you become one with the whole, because in meditation you cannot divide yourself from the whole, because all divisions have fallen. You are so silent that no boundary is there. Every boundary is a disturbance. You are so silent there is no I, no thou. You are so silent that all boundaries have blurred and disappeared. One exists. Unity exists. This is what Hindus call the Brahma, the One, the unity, the ultimate unity of existence. It is mind that divides, makes distinctions, says this is this, that is that. In meditation there is isness undivided. You are God when you are in meditation. And only in meditation you will come to know unconditional love. If you are a father, your both children will be just children, strangers coming from an unknown world, moving into an unknown existence, growing, maturing. And out of your love, you give them, you share your life, your experiences, but you never force anything. And when you don't force, who is obedient and who is disobedient? When you don't force, how can you decide who is good and who is bad? And now I come to the last point. When you don't force, how one can be obedient and another can be disobedient? The whole phenomenon disappears. Then you accept the other, the child, the wife, the husband, the friend, as he is, as a fact. If we can accept each other as facts, without any arts, suits, without any good and bad, life will become paradise this very moment. We reject. Even if we accept somebody, we accept in part. We say that your eyes are good, but everything else is just dirty. Is this acceptance? We say your this act is good, but all else is bad, cannot be accepted. And I accept only that which is good. That means I accept only that which is according to me. You may not be knowing how you are destroying each other. Because whenever the parents say to the child that I accept only this part, not anything else. When a wife says to the husband that I accept only this in you, not the other, what you are doing? You are creating a division in the other's mind also. When the father says that don't do this, I don't accept this, I am angry about this. When he punishes a child because he thinks he has done something wrong. When he appreciates the child, gives him a toy, brings flowers for him, sweets, and says, you have done well. You have done something good which I approve. What he is doing? He is creating a division in the child. By and by, the child will also reject the part that the parents have rejected. And he will be divided, he will become two eyes. You may have observed little children. They even punish themselves. They even talk to themselves that, Bobby, this is not good. You have done a bad thing. They start rejecting the part that has been rejected by their parents. Then a division is created. The rejected part becomes the unconscious, the suppressed part. And the accepted part becomes the conscience, the conscious. Then their whole life will be a hell, because the rejected and the accepted will go on fighting. Continuously there will be a turmoil. The rejected cannot be destroyed. It is you. It is there. It is always working within you. You may have put it in the dark, that's all. But once you put your part in the dark, that part becomes more forcible because it works through darkness and you cannot see and you cannot be aware about it. And it takes its own revenge. Whenever there is a weak moment and your conscious part is not very strong, it will come out. You may be good for 23 hours, but 1 hour, when the conscious is tired, the unconscious asserts. So even saints have their sinner moments. Even saints have to give a leave to their saintlyhood. They are on holidays. Sometimes they have to be. So if you catch a saint on his holiday, don't be disturbed too much. Everybody has to be on his holiday. Everybody gets tired. Unless one is whole, then there is no tiredness, because there is no other part who is constantly fighting, creating trouble, asserting, taking revenge. So we have two words. One is the saint, another is the sage. The saint is always with the sinner within him, hidden. The sage is the whole. The sage cannot be on holiday because he is always on the holiday. There is no rejected part. He lives as a whole totality. He moves moment to moment as a whole. He never rejects anything. He has accepted himself completely. But this rejection is created by the parents, by the society. A small child is always a great discoverer. And of course he begins his discovery with his own body. And that is the nearest existence to him. And he cannot go to the moon. He cannot go to the Everest. They are very far. Someday he will go. But right now the nearest part is his own body. He starts discovering it. He touches his body, he enjoys. See, observe a little child touching his toes and happy as you cannot be even if you go to the moon. He has discovered his body. He touches his toe, enjoys it, brings it to his mouth. Because these are the ways how he discovers. He will taste it, smell it, touch it. But when he will come to his sexual parts, parents become disturbed. That disturbance is in the parents, not in the child. He does not make any distinctions, though. Are the sexual organs are the same. There is no division in his body up to now. The whole body is there. Fingers, eyes, nose, sexual organs, toes are one fellow. There is no division of lower and higher. Hindus have a division all over the world. All the cultures have divisions. Hindus say, never touch with your right hand below the navel. Because that part below the navel is dirty. Touch below navel by your left hand. Touch above navel by your right hand. Body is divided. And the division has gone so deep in the mind that by right we mean good. We say, you are right. By left we mean bad. So if you want to condemn somebody, just say he is a leftist, a communist. The left is bad. The child doesn't know which is left, which is right. The child is whole. He is a unity. He doesn't know which is lower, which is higher. The body is undivided fellow. He will come to discover his sexual part, and parents are disturbed. whenever a child, boy or girl, touches the sexual organ, immediately we say, don't touch. We remove the hand. The child is shocked. You have given an electric shock to him. He cannot understand what you are doing. And this will happen many times. And you are hammering to the child that something in the body has to be rejected. The sexual part of the body is bad. Psychologically, you are creating a complex. The child will grow, but he will never be able to accept his sexual organs. And if you cannot accept your body in its totality, there will be problems, there will be trouble. Because the child will make love, he will move into sexual act, but there will be guilt, something wrong is going on. Something basically wrong is happening. He is condemning himself, making love the most beautiful thing in the world. He is condemning and is guilty. He cannot make love totally. He cannot move totally into the other because he is holding. The half is moving, the half is being controlled. This creates a conflict and love becomes a misery. And this happens in all the dimensions of life. Everything becomes miserable because in everything the parents have created a division. This is good and that is bad. This is how you are miserable because of your parents, the society. Don't do the same to your children. It will be very difficult because you are divided. You would like to divide the child. It is unconscious. But if you become alert, if you are really meditating, you will become alert. Don't create the same schizophrenia in your child. Don't divide. Don't make a split. You have suffered enough. Don't create the same suffering for your child. If you really love, you will not divide him, because division creates suffering. You will help him to remain whole, because wholeness is holy, and wholeness gives ecstatic possibilities, opens doors for peak of experiences. How can you help a child to remain whole? One thing, remain alert so you don't divide him unconsciously. Don't condemn a thing. If you feel it is harmful, tell to the child that this is harmful, but don't say this is bad. Because when you say harmful, you are stating a fact. When you say bad, you have brought a valuation in it. Parents have to say many things to the children because children doesn't know. You have to say that don't go near the fire. But see, this is harmful. If you get burnt, you will suffer. But then still it is up to you. This is my experience, that whenever I was burnt, I suffered. And I tell you my experience. But even if you want to do it, you can do it. This is harmful. Say what is harmful, say what is beneficial, but don't say good and bad. If you are alert, you will drop the word good and bad from your vocabulary. Because with good and bad, you are bringing your valuation to things. Say harmful. And still allow freedom. Because your experience cannot become the children's experience. They will have to experience themselves. Sometimes even harmful things will have to be done. Only they can grow then. Sometimes they will have to fall and get hurt. Only then they will know. They have to pass through things. hurt and is scared. But that is the only way how one grows. If you protect the child too much, he will not grow. And many people remain children. Their mental age never grows that of a child. They become old, they may be 70, but their mental age remains near about 7. Because they have been so much protected. Look at very rich families where children are protected too much, not allowed any freedom to hear, to experience, to be, to go after, to go after, when almost every moment somebody is following them, the servants, the tutors, the governess, they are never left alone. Then look what happens to them. Almost always, rich families produce mediocre children. Stupid, silly. Great minds have never been coming from rich families. Difficult. Innovators never come from them. Adventurers never come from them. They cannot. They are so much protected. They never grow. Unprotectedness is also needed. Protectiveness is also needed. Both are needed. Look at a gardener working with his trees. He helps them. He protects them. But still he gives them freedom to move in the sun, in the rains, in the storm. He will not take those trees inside the house to protect from the storm and from the sun and from the dangers that are always there outside. If you take the tree inside, it will die. A hard house plant is unnatural. And we all become hard house plants because of too much protecting parents. Don't protect the children. Don't leave them unprotected. Follow them as a shadow. Look after them, be careful, and create a balance. So whenever it is so dangerous that they may die, you protect them. But whenever you feel that it is not going to be so dangerous, you allow them. And the more they grow, the more you allow. By the time a child becomes sexually mature, you should give him total freedom. Because the nature has made him a man now. Now no need to be too much worried. Sometimes accidents will happen, but they are worth. Give the child a wholeness. Make him infectious to your awareness. Love him. Say to him, what is your experience? But don't try to make him follow your experience. Don't force. If he follows of his own accord, it is good. If he doesn't follow, wait. There is no hurry. It is difficult to be a father or to be a mother, the most difficult thing in the world. And people think this is the easiest. I have heard one woman was coming in a taxi to her home from the market. And the taxi driver was just crazy. He was going zigzag, and any moment there will be accident. And he was going so fast, and the woman was very much nervous, sitting on the edge of the seat. And many times he said, "Don't go so fast, I'm scared." But he won't listen. Then she said, listen, 12 children are waiting for me at my house. If something goes wrong, what will happen to 12 children? So the driver said, and you are saying to me to be alert. Difficult to follow it. He is saying 12 children you have given birth and you were not alert. And you are saying to me to be alert in driving. It is easy to give birth to many children. There is no problem. Even animals do it easily. But to be a mother is very difficult, the most difficult thing in the world. But to be a father, even more difficult. Because to be a mother is natural. To be a father is not so natural. Father is a social phenomenon. We have created the father. It doesn't exist in nature. Mother exists in nature. To be a father is still more difficult. Because there is no natural instinct for it. And this is difficult because this is the most creative act, to create a human being. Be alert, give more freedom, don't make distinctions of good and bad, accept both, and help both types to grow. Soon, this helping the children to grow will become a deep meditation for you. You will also grow with them. And when your child flowers into a yes-sayer or a no-sayer, because there have been beautiful no-sayers. Nitshe is a no-sayer, but beautiful. His genius to say no is such a wonderful and beautiful phenomenon that the world will be not so rich if there were not people like Nietzsche. He cannot say yes. It is difficult for him. No is his whole being. Buddha is a no-sayer. He said, there is no Brahm. There is no soul. There is no world. You cannot find a greater no-sayer. He left nothing. There have been yes-sayers, the devotees, the bhaktas, Nira, Chaitanya, or Jesus, or Muhammad. These are yes-sayers. And there are two types of religion, of course. One which are around a no-sayer. The other religions which are around a yes-sayer. And you also will belong to some. If you are a no-sayer, then Buddhism will be a great help to you. If you are a yes-sayer, then Buddhism cannot help you at all. It will be destructive. Christianity can help. Hinduism can help. And both are needed. When I say, I mean they always exist in a proportion. Just like men and women. Almost always the number is the same. The whole world is divided. Half men, half women. And how nature keeps this proportion is a miracle. In every other dimension, the same proportion is maintained. Always half no-sayers and half yes-sayers in the world. Always half who can follow the path of knowledge and half who can follow the path of love. Love is yes saying. Knowledge is always no saying. And this proportion is maintained by nature always. So if you have got two children, one is a yes sayer and another is a no sayer, this is the proportion. This is good that you have got both in your home. You can create a harmony out of them. Don't try to destroy the no sayer. Don't try to push and help the yes sayer only. Create a harmony between the two. These two children are representative of the whole world, the yin and yang, the opposites, the polars. Create a harmony between them and your family will be a family, a unit, a harmonious unit. But don't interpret, don't condemn, don't be moralistic. Just be a father, a mother, love them and accept them and help them to be themselves. This is the base of our love, to help the other to be himself. If you want to pull, manipulate, you are not in love, you are destructive.
In the West, many of our growth methods are group methods, like in cancer and psychodrama, many of the new methods. And in the East, although there are ashrams, the growth is on the individual thing. And yet, we're usually together, and although we're not in an ashram, here we are together. Can you tell us what the togetherness and the separation place in growth?
There are two types of growth methods. You can work your spiritual growth alone, or you can work through a group, through a school. And both types have always existed, even in the East. Sufi methods are group methods. In India also, group methods have existed, but were never so much prevalent as in Islam or Sufism. But this is a new phenomenon as far as quantity is concerned, that the West is totally group-oriented. Never before so much group methods were there, alive, and so many people working through them as they exist now in the West. So anyway, we can say that East has remained with individual efforts and West now growing towards group methods. Why this is so, and what is the difference, and why this difference? Group methods can exist only if your ego has come to a point where it is a burden to carry it. When the ego has become so burdensome that to be alone is to be in anguish, then group methods become meaningful. Because in a group you can merge your ego. If the ego is not very evolved, then individual methods can help you. You can move to a mountain, you can be isolated. Or even living in an ashram with a master, you work alone. You do your meditation, others do their meditation. You never work together. In India, Hindus have never been praying in groups. With Mohammedans, group prayer entered India. Mohammedans pray in groups. Hindus were always praying alone. Even if they get to the temple, they will go alone. It is one-to-one relationship, you and your God. This is possible if the ego has not been helped to grow to a point where it becomes a burden. And in India it has never been helped to grow. From the very beginning we are against the ego. So you grow in ego, but the ego remains vague, blurred. You remain humble. You are not really an egotist. It is not a penetrating peak in you. It is a flat ground. You are egoist, because everybody has to be, but not absolute egoist. You always think this is wrong, and you always go on pulling yourself down. In certain situations you can be provoked and your ego becomes a peak, but ordinarily it is not a peak, it is a flat ground. In India, ego is just like anger. If someone provokes you, you become angry. If nobody provokes you, you are non-angry. In the West, the ego has become a permanent substance. It is not like anger, it is now like breathing. There is no need to provoke it. It is there. It is a constant phenomenon. Because of this ego, group becomes a very helpful thing. In the group, working with a group, merging yourself in the group, you can put your ego aside easily. That's why not only in religion but in politics also, few phenomena can exist only in the West. Fascism, for example, could exist, could become possible in Germany, which is the most egoist in the West, the most Western. There is nothing like German ego all over the world. That's why Hitler could become possible. Because everyone is so egoist, everybody is in need of merger. Nazi rallies, millions of people marching. You can lose yourself. You need not be yourself there. You become the march, the band playing, the music, the sound, a hypnotizing Hitler, a charismatic personality. Everybody looking at Hitler. The whole mass around you, like an ocean, you become just a wave. You feel good, you feel fresh, you feel young, you feel happy, you forget your misery, your anguish, your loneliness, your alienation. You are not alone. Such a great mass is with you and you are with it. Your individual private worries drop. Suddenly there is an opening. You feel light, as if you are flying. Hitler became successful not because he had a very meaningful philosophy. His philosophy was absurd. It was childish, immature. Not that he could convince the German people that he is right. That is not the point. It is very difficult to convince German people. One of the most difficult things. Because they are logicians, they have logic in their mind, rational. In every way, it is difficult to convince them. And to be convinced by Hitler would have been impossible. No, he never tried to convince them. He created a hypnotic group phenomena that convinced them. Because it was not a question what Hitler is saying, it was a question what they were feeling when they were in the group, in the mass. It was such an unburdening experience that it was worth to follow this man. whatsoever he was saying, wrong or right, logical, illogical, foolish, it was good to follow him. They were so much bored with themselves, they wanted to be absorbed by the mass. That's why fascism, Nazism, and all types of group madnesses became possible in the West. In the East, only Japan could follow. Because Japan is the counterpart of Germany in the East. Japan is the most Western country in the East. The same phenomenon was there. Japan could become an ally with the Hitlerite madness. The same is happening in other fields also, in religion also, in psychology also. Group meditation is happening. And only group meditation will happen for a long period to come. When 100 people are together, you will be surprised, particularly those who don't know the Western mind, they will be surprised. Just holding hands, 100 people sitting, just holding hands, feeling each other, and they feel elated. You will not feel elated. No Indian will feel elated. He will say, what nonsense. Just holding hands with 100 people sitting in a circle, how it can be an elation? How you can become ecstatic? You can feel at the most the perspiration of the other's hands. But in the West, 100 people holding hands are elated, ecstatic. Why? Because even holding hands has become so impossible because of the ego. Even wife and husband are not together. The joint family has disappeared. It was a group phenomenon. The society has disappeared. In the West, now there is no society exists. You move alone. In America, I was reading the statistics. Every man moves within 3 years to another town. Now a man exists in a village in India. He has remained there. Not only he, his family has remained there for thousands of years. He is deeply rooted on that soil. He is related with everyone. He knows everybody. Everybody knows him. He is not a stranger. He is not alone. He lives as part of the village. He has always lived. He was born there. He will die there. In America, every 3 years, average, people are moving. This is the most nomadic civilization that has ever existed. Vagabonds. No house, no family, no town, no village, no home really. In 3 years, how can you get rooted? Wherever you go, you are a stranger. The mass is around, but you are not related to it. Unrelated. The whole burden becomes individual. Sitting in a group, in an encounter group, or in a group, touching each other's body, you become part of the community. Touching each other's hand, holding each other's hand, just lying near each other, lying on top of each other in a pile, and you feel oneness. A religious elation happens. 100 people dancing, touching each other, moving around each other, become one, they merge. The ego is dissolved for a few moments. That merger becomes a prayerful thing. Politicians can use it for destructive ends. Religion can use it for very creative phenomena. It can become a meditation. In the East, people are too much in the community. So whenever they want to be religious, they want to go to the Himalayas. The society is too much around. They are not fed up with themselves, they are fed up with the society. This is the difference. In the West, you are fed up with yourself. And you want some bridge, how to be communicated with the society, with others. How to create a bridge, how to move to the other, so you can forget yourself. In the East, people are fed up with the society. They have lived with it so long. And the society is so all around, they don't feel any freedom. So whenever somebody wants to be free, to be silent, he runs to the Himalayas. In the West, you run to the society. In the East, people run from the society. That's why lonely methods, individual methods have existed in the East. Group methods are in existence in the West. What I am doing, because my method is a synthesis. In the first steps of dynamic meditation, you are part of the group. In the last part, the group disappears, you are alone. And I am doing it for a particular reason. Because now East and West have become irrelevant. The East is turning towards West, the West is turning towards East. By the end of this century, there will be no East and no West, one world. This geographical division has existed too long, this cannot exist anymore. Technology has already dissolved it. It is already out of existence, but because of a habitual attitude in the mind, it continues. It continues only as a mental phenomena. Actually, it is no more. By the end of this century, there will be no East, no West, just one world. It is already there. Those who can see, they can see it is already there. A synthesis will be needed. Group and individual both. You work in the group in the beginning. In the end, you become totally yourself. Start from the society and reach to yourself. Don't escape from the community. Live in the world, but don't be of it. Be related, still remain alone. Love and meditate. Meditate and love. Whatsoever happens before is not, whatsoever follows is not the question. Meditate and love, if you are a man. Love and meditate if you are a woman. But don't choose. Love plus meditation is my slogan.